The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Heart failure due to reduced ejection fraction, medical management, is presented by Dr. David Allen.
All right, the applause can stop. Thank you. Anyway, we have a big topic to cover here. I was asked to talk about basically the treatment of heart failure, which is a very, very big topic. And I titled this Meds to Machines because if you really think about it, if you think about how heart failure management has evolved, we've gone from meds and some new advancements in medications, which I'm going to address, and the proliferation of device therapy, including BIVI and resynchronization therapy and LVADs. So I was told this was mostly a surgical audience, and how do you make a treatment of heart failure appeal to the surgical audience? I'm not quite sure, but I'll do the best I can, the medical treatment. And I guess, the reason I'm asked to kind of speak about this is obviously heart failure is one of our biggest diagnoses that we see in the hospital. Over 825,000 people greater than 45 years of age are newly diagnosed with heart failure. And that stat is probably a little old. It's probably around 950 now. And most hospitals have their 30-day readmission and mortality indices, which if you deal with administration, are of great concern to them based on CMS reimbursement. And, these are the kind of the boring slides in the beginning that lay the foundation. And the only reason we bring these up is the staging and the functional class have a lot to do with how we approach the treatment of heart failure. And what I kind of deal with in a lot of detail is the stage D refractory heart failure requiring specialized interventions. But the majority of heart failure management we can't forget. Everyone likes to talk about new exciting advances and LVADs and devices, but the reality of it is we actually don't do that great of a job at treating stage B and C and perhaps A, else people wouldn't be getting to D as much. And it's important because the mortality is exceedingly high. When we have the big C diagnosis, we take that very seriously, but no one really blinks as much when they're told or when they're in the hospital with heart failure. But in fact, the mortality with NYHA3 is 10 to 45% annually, and NYHA4, 50 to 75%. And I even think 2 is kind of important to look at, a 3 to 25%, because those are the people that really don't feel that symptomatic. But you're seeing quite a range of mortality, which is an important thing to remember when you're trying to decide how aggressive to be with their medical therapy when you think they're doing relatively fine, haven't been in the hospital, but their mortality can approach 20% annually, which is pretty significant. And the evolution of congestive heart failure is important to briefly understand because that's where we get our treatment. That's where, in the past they said, if we just make the heart squeeze harder, that's how we treat heart failure, until we found out that actually increased mortality. So the initial event is the myocardial insult, whether that be an infection or an MI or an ischemic event, which leads to a depression in myocardial function, which the heart compensates by dilating to maintain stroke volume, and that is done by myocyte elongation. And eventually, you increase diastolic wall stress and decrease energy supply, and over time, you get activation, or not over time, but immediately, and then over time, the activation of the sympathetic nervous system and the RAS system leads to progression of heart failure. These are all good compensatory responses. If you have decreased perfusion in your kidney, you actually want to increase your blood pressure, you want to increase your heart rate, but they are deleterious over time, leading to progressive fibrosis within the myocardium. So our treatment has been to reduce those long-term neural hormonal effects. I always say when you put someone on an ACE inhibitor and beta blocker, you're really not treating heart failure acutely, you're treating them for the long term. The acute management of heart failure is, well, obviously if they're low output is perhaps if they're that sick, an inotrope, but you know, we're just decongesting them with diuretics. But the ACE inhibitor and a beta blocker and the aldosterone, you really should look at it more as a long-term strategy to decrease the toxic effects of neurohormonal activation. And more acutely, you can decrease afterload and decrease preload. And so how has treatment progressed? These are old trials. This is not groundbreaking information here. But when we looked at consensus, that was the ACE inhibitor trial in 87. VHEFT was looking at isodil and hydralazine in self-described African-Americans. U.S. Carveda Law was the first trial in 1996 to show the mortality benefit of beta blockers. Eventually, Seibas and Copernicus and Merritt firmly established beta blockers in treatment of heart failure. And before my time of practicing, it was once thought you were crazy to give a beta blocker in someone with a low EF. You're just going to further reduce their myocardial function. And then there was Rails in 1998. So as we see, the reduction in mortality with ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, with the ACE inhibitors, SOLVE showed a 16% reduction in mortality at 3 years. Consensus showed a 40% in 1 year. Beta blockers showed even an improved reduction in mortality. With MERIT-HF, which was a metoprolol succinate trial, U.S. Carveda Law trial, and Copernicus. So these outcomes purely defined ACE inhibitors and beta blockers in the treatment of heart failure. And if we think back to the 1800s, we come a long way, where bloodletting, which was a remedy that was used to basically bleed the patient out to decrease their humors, as they say, to reduce their volume to treat heart failure. This was done by surgeons, and I'm sure even back then, scholars noted probably only about a 15 to 30 cc blood loss during that. Anyway, the thanks, Ron, for laughing at that one. The drugs that reduce mortality in heart failure with reduced EF, angiotensin receptor blockers, as you see, ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, immunerato corticosteroid receptor antagonists. So as you see, there's a significant reduction. And more recently, everyone's kind of got excited when the PARADIGM-HF trial came out, showing the clinical benefit, 20% reduction in a combined outcome of mortality and heart failure admission with the combined neprilysin inhibition and angiotensin receptor blockade with sacubitril and valsartan. And, you know, when we check labs and we see a BNP is elevated, that's actually a good thing. That's an natriuretic peptide. That's your heart experiencing myocardial wall stress and trying to say, hey, listen, we got to get some volume off. Let's increase our natriuretic peptide. Interestingly enough, that natriuretic peptide release is often immature and doesn't have as much of a biologic effect as we had hoped. So that's why you can see people with a BNP of like 50, or NT-proBNP of like 20,000 and still be markedly volume overloaded. But the natriuretic peptides are very important. They decrease the myocardial cardiac fibrosis, they decrease sodium retention, they decrease vascular tone. And neprilysin is there to break them down to inactive metabolites. So targeting neprilysin inhibition is an important strategy. And combining that with valsartan, which we all know is an angiotensin receptor blocker. So when you combine the two, the PARADIGM-HF trial looked at this, and the LCZ696, which is a beautiful name, but eventually put to Entresto, they did a single-blind run-in trial. A single-blind run-in basically just means that you have to accept, you have to be able to tolerate the max dose of enalapril before you got into the LCZ696 arm, and then up-titrated to the max dose. And as you can see, there the KM curve, this Kaplan-Meier curve, shows a deviation in cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization right from the beginning. And I think most trials, it's important to note the deviation occurs right away. So if you go back and look at the beta blocker trials, MERIT-HF, Copernicus, or not Copernicus, Carvedilol, U.S. Carvedilol trial, you'll see that it actually doesn't deviate. The KM curves don't deviate until 3 months out, which is a pretty important distinction. If you narrow it in on this region right here, you get a deviation in the KM curve in mortality right from the get-go. So the hazard ratio is 0.8, meaning a 20% reduction in the endpoint, which was a significant reduction. And obviously, you can't read that slide, but the point of these slides here is to show you that no matter what, if you try to break it down by age, or if you try to break it down by New York Heart Association class, or sex, or race, or pre-existing blood pressure, everything in the study favored the LCC-696 arm as with the primary endpoint, because everything was off to the left there. So in effect, it actually doubled the mortality benefit of the ACE inhibitor or ARB that we currently accept as standard of therapy. And this actually led to the ACC, AHA, and ESC changing their guidelines to recommend as a class 1B recommendation. 1B just means B, meaning that there's only one study to support the class 1 recommendation. A, meaning there's multiple studies. But 1B recommendation now as standard of care for patients with heart failure with reduced EF 35% or less. Importantly, the trial started with an EF 40% or less, but it was then changed to 35% or less. And then to move on as far as advances in or some pharmacologic therapy that you may not be too aware of, there's the funny channel inhibitor ibubradin. This is a unique model of treating heart failure in reduction of heart rate. So really, it's not any neurohormonal modulation. It is not modulating the sympathetic nervous system, which you're doing with a beta blocker. What you're purely doing is reducing the heart rate. And in the SHIFT trial, it showed, it looked at patients with moderate to severe chronic heart failure, EF less than 35%, heart rate greater than 70, and on best recommended therapy. Usually the limitation is a blood pressure limitation, meaning they can't uptitrate their beta blocker due to blood pressure limitations that you had. 6,500 patients, and in 2012, the European Medicines Agency granted the indication for ibubradin and chronic heart failure in class 2 to 4, and the ESC guidelines in 2012 used it for the guidelines for heart failure include ibubradin and the algorithm for the treatment of heart failure. As you can see, the primary endpoint versus placebo in patients with cardiovascular death or hospitalization for heart failure, there was an 18% reduction versus placebo in the trial. And the effect of ibubradin carried over to all groups as well, as you see on the left there for New York Heart Association class and baseline heart rate. If you haven't had any clinical experience with it, it is actually a pretty profound reduction in heart rate. They tend to reduce their heart rate by about 20 beats per minute. Obviously, that depends on what dose you're using, but I tend to use it on patients with a heart rate over 90 who I'm on max beta blocker therapy to further reduce their heart failure. You have to be careful if you think they're low output or not, though, if they're more advanced heart failure, because you don't want to necessarily take away their overall cardiac output. So I'm going to skip over that for the basis of time. It significantly reduces major risks associated with heart failure, an 18% reduction in cardiovascular death and 26% reduction in heart failure. And those were the two newer pharmacologic therapies. When we think about treating heart failure, we really haven't had many significant advances in medical therapy. And a lot of the advances have been in device therapy. And that's why I work so closely with our EP colleagues, because EP and heart failure are kind of married, as you would guess. They like us because we send them a lot of device implants. And we like them because they send them back to us. So the trials, as you see here, there's quite a list here, but if you look at, we're not going to go through all these, but the study features on how they were selected generally revolved around EF of 35% or less, and then other modifying factors such as signal average EKG or PVCs in a minute or positive EP study, until we got to more all-inclusive studies such as Scudheft, which was more inclusive than the original MADIT and MADIT 2 trials. And the prevalence, when we talk about interventricular conduction delay, the general heart failure population has around a 15% incidence of IVCD that's basically just looking at the EKG and seeing prolongation of the QRS. In the mild to severe heart failure population, this rises. And the importance of that is the wider the QRS, the worse they do. I mean, a wide QRS is a sign of a sicker heart. It's a sign of a longer acting conduction through the myocardium. And whether that be scar-based or whether that be due to remodeling of the heart over time, as you can see, the cumulative survival with increase in duration of your QRS is worse. So resynchronization therapy aims to address this, and the companion trial was the major trial first to address this with EF less than 35%, QRS greater than 120, class 3 or New York Heart Association 3 or 4 heart failure, and they're put out to medical CRT or CRT and ICD. And the annual mortality in the medical group was 19%, CRT was 15%, and CRT ICD was 12%. Cardiovascular death and heart failure hospitalization was also significantly reduced if you look at that graph there as well. But it's important to not just say, okay, we have the CRT in, we're good. Okay, we got the EP docs, they put in the BIVI ICD, now I have his heart failure treated. Because we do know there's a lot of people that we put a BIVI or a CRT device in that do not, quote, respond. And are they not responders, or are we not adequately managing, or are we not putting the lead in the right place, or are they actually getting paced enough? The whole point of having a BIVI device is for BIVI pacing. So if you go and interrogate their device and they're being paced 85% of the time, that's not ideal. And this shows this, and this was published in JACC in 2009, even 97%, look at the difference, event-free probability of 97% pacing versus 100% pacing. So I would urge you to take a look at your ICD and device interrogations and see if they're being adequately BIVI paced, whether that's upping their beta blocker or their basal rate of what they're being paced at. It's important on outcomes to address how often they're being paced. So the changes in LV and systolic volume and EF were significantly different in the CRT group versus the control group, as you see there. And I actually think the end systolic volume is more important than the EF. I mean, when you think about it, when you have heart failure, the negative sign that you see remodeling is LV dilatation. When you see remodeling of the LV and the LV is getting smaller, that's a positive sign, and that's what I look for the most. I mean, the EF kind of comes secondarily with that, but the changes in volume is very important. Conventional echocardiographic measures may predict unfavorable response after CRT. So, you know, you got a really sick heart failure patient, you're sitting there and you're like, should we just throw in a BIVI device? Is that going to make them better? And oftentimes that isn't really the case. And when you got patients with a severely dilated LV and a very thin myocardium, their probability, you see the end diastolic wall thickness less than 6 millimeter, end diastolic greater than 250, and EF extremely low. You know, most people aren't going to sit and memorize these specific numbers, but your gist is you got a severely dilated heart, very low EF, your probability of positive response is going to be less. And the benefit with ischemic cardiomyopathy, it's important the scar burden is less likely to burn from CRT. Now, that comes down to LV lead position, which some of our EP colleagues could better speak of than me, but if you can only imagine that if you're trying to pace in an area of a large scar burden, that your response to resynchronization therapy is not going to be as favorable. So limited impact of CRT in advanced ischemic cardiomyopathy. As you see there, the green is the ischemic etiology, the purple is non-ischemic, and the change from baseline in LV and systolic volume is much less in the ischemic etiology, and the EF improvement is much less as well. So what other options do we have? We have CRT. You say, okay, they didn't respond to CRT. They're getting sick. We have them on max medical therapy. And so we classically, we all know about heart transplant and whether you work at a transplant center or not. Is heart transplant the total solution? Well, obviously it's a great solution for a distinct small class of patients. However, if you have 300,000 or 400,000 class 4 heart failure patients and only 2,200 heart donations a year, that's kind of like saying that winning the lottery is the treatment or the cure for poverty. You really can't use that and say, okay, we're going to treat all these stage D heart failure patients with transplant when there's only a limited supply. It still is the standard of care. I'm not putting that down. Your 10-year survival is around 50%. 1-year survival is around 86%. But as you can see here, when you update this to 2017, this data has not changed. The number of transplants being done in green in North America has stayed steady. Perhaps a little bit of rise in the last couple of years with unfortunately, texting and driving and the heroin epidemic, but the numbers have relatively stayed the same, around 2,200 transplants a year. You would think as we progress from year to year, oh, we're doing more and more transplants, but that actually isn't the case. So we have to restrict transplant to the sickest of the sick patients. And these are the patients that are, once you're implanted with an LVAD, you have a 30-day usage that you can use a 1A time for transplantation. Also, if you're on a total artificial heart or intra-aortic balloon pump or ECMO, you qualify for 1A status. 1B is you can use if you're on mechanical circulatory support and you do have some evidence of complications such as infection or device thrombus. And you can choose to use your 30-day time at any given point during that waiting period. And with status 1B is dependent on IV medications. We have a lot of patients I manage are on home milrinone, and we're trying to get them through to transplantability, which we just recently got 2 through to transplantability, just keeping them on IV milrinone at home. And status 2 is stable on oral medications and able to wait at home. And status 7 is kind of like they're on the back burner and we're following them. The wait times are affected by your blood type. O is obviously the hardest to match. Your weight, obesity affects it, height, region, and PRA. PRA is panel reactive antigenicity, and our antibody, which is basically antigenicity. It's basically, PRA is, think of this as like, if your PRA is 10%, they're saying that you'll cross-react with about 10% of the possible patient donor pool. So the higher your PRA, the worse. You call it sensitized if your PRA is high. That means that you're going to cross-react with a lot of donors, and it makes it more difficult for you to get transplanted. Women tend to have higher PRAs. If you have an LVAD, you tend to have a higher PRAs. If you got blood transfusion, if you're a peripartum cardiomyopathy and you just delivered, you have a high antigenicity. So the best estimates are 250,000 patients. Only 1% will receive a transplant. So the LVAD can serve as a bridge. The first VAD was 1978, first used as a bridge to transplant, and the patient received a heart transplant 5 days later. And this was the Jarvik 7 in 1982 was implanted on a patient named Barney Clark for destination therapy, and he lived for 112 days. And then along came the HeartMate XVE. This was a vented device. It did have pulsatility to it, and a rather large device at 1,150 grams, and used in the first approved in the early 90s and approved for destination therapy later in the early 2000s. And I'm skipping through this only for the sake of time of going through the history of it. The one that is currently being used the most, there are other devices. There is a HeartWare device, and the HeartMate 2, as you can see, offered a substantial decrease in size. The HeartMate XVE allowed patients to actually go home and wait for transplant, which is a huge step in the progression of mechanical circulatory support. And as you can see the size difference there, the XVE was 1,150 grams. The HeartMate 2 was 350 grams, so a third of the weight. And this is important, actually, when you come down to women and smaller patients and actually pediatric population. It allowed pediatric population to be implanted. And the pulsatile, the XVE is the top one. As you can see, it was more of a pulsatile device, much larger device. And the HeartMate 2 is an axial flow device. That propelled the blood out from the left ventricle out the aortic outflow graft. In 2003, the first HeartMate 2 was implanted in the US, and this is a typical x-ray of a patient with a HeartMate 2. device. He was an 18-year-old non-ischemic cardiomyopathy patient. And the study shown HeartMate 2 versus HeartMate 1, the one-year, the initial trial showed significant improvement in the continuous flow LVAD versus the pulsatile flow LVAD, which interestingly enough, we're back to a little bit of pulsatility in a flow at 1 and 2 years. And the post-approval study showed a 90% actuary survival and an 85% one-year survival, which is really significant when you look at the survival of stage D heart failure patients and compare it. It's quite an improvement in survival. So HeartMate, two indications for non-reversible heart failure and imminent risk of death and candidate for cardiac transplant. You can use it as a bridge to transplant, or you can use it as destination therapy after they've been on optimal medical therapy. This is per CMS guidelines, and not, deemed not a candidate for cardiac transplantation. The FDA CMS criteria for destination therapy is life expectancy less than 2 years, and peak VO2 that's attained by CPET testing, EF less than 25, and within a certain body surface area, certain institutions try to play with that body surface area a little bit. And there's actually a little bit of an obesity paradox with putting in devices in that really thin and cachectic patients don't do well, and obese patients actually do better. But they're not a candidate for transplant. So early evaluation for VAD is actually very important. I deal with this all the time when people send me patients that their RV is shot. And that's really, you can't really LVAD a patient with a shot RV, because you could support the LV all you want, but if the RV is not working, you're in a lot of trouble. And it's important because they really do drop off once they're at the stage four. We all know this. We have patients, I've been diagnosed 10 years ago, and they said I had 6 months to live, and here I am 10 years later, until they actually get to the point where, well, you actually are at that point now. So they actually, and the indications for this, the signs that you'll see is they actually start losing weight. They get cardiac cachectic, they're in the hospital a lot, their functional capacity is severely reduced, they may get mental status or memory changes as well. These are important signs to look for. So it's important to consider LVAD early on. And the Intermax profile is something we use for our stage D heart failure patients to further break them down. We try to implant mostly Intermax 3, that's stable on inotropes, but oftentimes we have to do Intermax 1 or 2, which are progressive decline on inotropic therapy. Earlier on, there was more 1 and 2 being done, but now there's more class 3 being done. So other modalities that we're in trying to cover everything that we utilize in the management of advanced heart failure is one of the major concerns that we have is heart failure readmissions and keeping people out of the hospital. And this is a very tough thing to tackle, because patients don't present with symptoms until they're pretty far into decongested state. And if you kind of see here, your filling pressures increase, your autonomic tone, autonomic adaptation, and not till here do you get your symptoms and weight gain. So it would be great if you could kind of detect the filling pressure increase first, so that you could avoid and make changes to their medical therapy to avoid the hospitalization. And how good are we at detecting this? I'd say the older physicians are much better. The younger physicians just order an echo. But the JVP is very important to assess, and we assess that on every one of our patients. The sensitivity and specificity, though, is somewhat limited. Your pulse pressure, a narrow pulse pressure, is actually an important thing to see in a patient. If you see their blood pressure is 90 over 70, you know they probably have a pretty sick heart, because their stroke volume is rather low. So the CardioMEMS system is an implantable PA pressure sensor monitor that we implant into the posterior pulmonary artery on the left side that measures and keeps track of the mean pulmonary artery pressure. Initially, it was mean pulmonary artery pressure. Now everyone's following pulmonary artery diastolic pressure. And in the CHAMPION trial, they looked at 270 patients treated with PA pressure monitoring and versus a control group with changes in treatment based on the numbers that you get. And these are kind of the data that you get for trends in your PA pressure that you can have a nurse kind of interpret in and look at the information. And what you'll see here is that in the treatment arm, There was a significant reduction in heart failure hospitalizations by PA pressure monitoring, 37% reduction in heart failure hospitalization versus the control. And when you compare that number needed to treat to prevent one heart failure hospitalization, there was 4 for cardioMEMS, and it was 7 for the beta blocker, aldosterone, and CRT. So a significant, actually a pretty useful intervention. Unfortunately, in the Northeast, it's not being covered right now by Novitas CMS, so you have to do it in non-Medicare patients in the Northeast. And as you see there, the benefit in HFpEF is even greater. And more recently, this is like fresh, pretty fresh, about a month off the press, the HeartMate 3, which is Abbott's new LVAD device, just got approved by the FDA on August 28th. It got approved for bridge to transplant therapy. And the device uses more of a magnetically full mag levitation to, and with increase, here if I can show you on this one, bigger, larger blood flow pathways. This is important because of hemolysis or risk for stroke. And the early data shows no evidence of thrombosis early on, which is a significant improvement over the HeartMate 2. We're still trying to gather data as far as bleeding. And this is how it looks compared to the HeartMate 2. It is a different device in that it has some pulsatility. I'm almost done. And you could say, okay, well, that's great. They live longer, but how's their quality of life? Anyone, you know, what's the importance if you make them live longer if their life isn't improved? And as you can see, there's a 77% improvement, 77% of patients improved significantly in a 6-minute walk test, which anyone can do pretty easily in their office to 300 meters. And the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire, this is basically to say, how do you perceive your quality of life? A 68% improvement in their quality of life, which is significant. So it's important not to just make people live longer. It's important to say, is this worthwhile to make you live longer? Are you enjoying your quality of life? And as we see so far with the HeartMate 3, device thrombus, 0. That's actually a pretty significant outcome. GI bleeding is still the bugaboo of device therapy, probably because of acquired von Willebrand deficiency. It cleaves the large multiple of von Willebrand, and they become bleeders. And we're looking at if Coumadin and aspirin are still needed or if we can remove aspirin. And the probability of event-free survival with the centrifugal flow pump was better than the axial flow in the early outcomes. And this is a picture of one of our LVAD patients. We took him out to dinner for his first LVAD birthday. We celebrate LVAD birthdays. And this is at one of our steakhouses nearby, and that's our LVAD team. And you can live pretty productive and go out and enjoy life after getting a VAD. You're not tied down to home, and people often feel that you're going to be restricted in your mobility and what you're able to do, and that's actually just not the case. These people are our first VAD. I mean, I came to St. Luke's 3 years ago. We implanted one month later, and he's still doing great 3 years later with, well, I don't want to jinx myself. He's doing great